1237 now on the Afternoon Magazine, and it's fairly quiet and overcast around the area. We may not see some sun for quite a while, unfortunately, but the weather will be quiet for the next couple of days as an area of high pressure is shifting east of the Great Lakes. Temperatures will continue to warm today as a southerly flow takes hold across the Midwest. The next chance of rain will move in from the west late tomorrow. A strong low-pressure system will bring possible thunderstorms and locally heavy rains to parts of the Midwest, with snow possible for the upper Midwest and Great Lakes tomorrow into Wednesday. So, in the meantime, we're going to see a cloudy day and not a whole lot of activity. The high of around 45, winds from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles an hour. Cloudy tonight and through tomorrow, 42 the low tonight. Warmer tomorrow, the high of around 55 degrees, and winds again out of the southeast, little gustier, 10 to 15 miles an hour. For Tuesday night, occasional showers and thunderstorms will move in, the low temperature of around 44. And on Wednesday, we'll start the day with showers and thunderstorms and a chance of some residual rain in the afternoon. Early high 52 on Wednesday, and then the temperature starts to slowly fall in the afternoon. Looking forward from there, turning colder Wednesday night, cloudy, chance of snow or rain in the evening, then snow possible after midnight. Mostly cloudy on Thursday, partly cloudy Thursday night through Sunday, with a slight chance of rain on Sunday. So by then, we may see a little bit of sunshine mixed in with the clouds. Thursday's high in the low 40s. Friday's high in the upper 30s after a high Thursday in the low 40s, mid-40s for Saturday and Sunday. Lows Wednesday night in the low 30s, Thursday night in the upper 20s, and Friday night in the upper 30s, back to the upper 20s for lows on Saturday night. Right now on Friends Plaza, it's 36 degrees, and our time is 12:39. Springfield has seen its share of snags in the city's fabric of race relations. Springfield is, of course, the home to Abraham Lincoln, but it was also witness to a deadly race riot. Racial equity became a divisive issue in the 70s when Springfield schools were placed under a federal desegregation order. While it provided more academic opportunity, it also meant the death of neighborhood schools and more forced busing. In the first of two reports that we'll bring you this week, Illinois Public Radio's Jenna Dooley looks at how the order came to be.
Carlotta Walls was 14 when she entered Central High School in Little Rock in 1957. She was a member of the Little Rock Nine, a group of African-American students who penetrated the doors of a white school. Walls says she feared lynching by a white mob in the days to follow.
Over this period of time, I have truly understood that we really did a monumental thing by staying. Okay, we weren't quitters once we started something. We had that type of mentality to want to complete the task.
By the 1970s, when Springfield instituted a desegregation policy, the path had been laid by pioneers like Walls. Still, it wasn't easy. Teresa Haley lived in the John Hay Housing Project when the desegregation measures took effect. In fourth grade, she and her neighbors were bused across the city to school. Socially, she says integration was a mixed bag.
These kids were dressed nice and neat. They had new clothes, and we wore hand-me-downs, you know. I would get teased if I wore something on Monday and then wore it again, let's say Thursday or Friday. So I made a conscious effort to say, okay, when's the last time I wore this? And, you know, when you have older sisters and brothers and your parents are struggling, you wear what's available to you. So I did notice the kids who came from working parents, the white children, they had nicer clothes, nicer shoes. You know, our shoes would have holes in them, and it was a big difference.
Haley is now the president of the Springfield chapter of the NAACP. We'll hear from her later. The effort to equalize education and close an achievement gap between white and black students began to take shape in 1970. That year, the NAACP provided the district school board with startling figures. Of Springfield's 32 elementary schools, 13 of them had no black students. 76% of all black students attended just three of those 32 elementary schools. The student body at Springfield Southeast High School was predominantly white, but 79% of all black students in the district attended Southeast. At that time, the NAACP told the District 186 School Board the proposal to eliminate segregation was based on three main factors: It was educationally sound, morally right, and a legal necessity. But it wasn't just the NAACP that wanted change. A group of fresh-faced professors at a new university in Springfield is also credited with getting the desegregation discussion really moving. Larry Golden was a professor at Sangamon State University in the 1970s. Years later, he sits casually in a coffee shop, remembering the tide changing.
There was a group of people, I think, within the Springfield community that had been concerned about this and other issues that realized that the presence of the university brought in an energy and a group of people that could begin to help deal with some of the issues that they had been struggling with over many years. I think it was a historical issue. It really was part of an extension of the civil rights movement. And Springfield tends to move very slowly, you know, more slowly than a lot of other places.
In a 1971 editorial in the Illinois State Journal, the newspaper wrote, "Although admittingly serious, the integration problem in Springfield is not one of such proportions that drastic remedies are required." A drastic remedy referred to busing students from neighborhoods to spread majorities and minorities to the city's schools. Former District 186 Superintendent Charles Matthews says that was a sticking point.
Well, each family who had been used to a neighborhood school, where children often walked to school, were upset that their child was going to have to get on the bus and perhaps go across town. And although there may have been some racial concerns in the background, the major was concerned, not my child. This is unfair. I purchased my home because I wanted my child to go to school in this building, and now it's not going to be possible.
A pending building referendum took the spotlight for district officials, and the desegregation conversation cooled off. In the meantime, the African-American community kept talking. Fast forward to April 1974. Citizens sued on behalf of students, charging the district with creating and fostering racial and ethnic segregation. The opening statements of the desegregation hearing pointed to Springfield's rich history of Abraham Lincoln, recognized as the man who freed the slaves and saved the Union, and as the state capital. It's a showcase district for the rest of the state. The court order was handed down. Former District 186 Superintendent Don Miedema was hired to move students around the district.
By the time I was here, really, we were not debating any longer the pros and cons of the order. The question is, how can we make it work? And to the best interest of the students and the community and so on. And I think people tried very hard to do that. And by and large, I think we're successful in doing it.
The district was divided into four quadrants where students were split to meet racial quotas. Former student Teresa Haley says despite some awkwardness, she made friends.
I remember this girl in school. Her name was Tacy. It's the first white girl I ever spent the night with, and I think we were in fifth grade. I was on the volleyball team, and my parents didn't have transportation. My mom didn't have transportation, and Tacy's dad was out of town. Her mom couldn't get me home, so her mom's like, well, just let her stay all night. And that was the first time I ever stayed all night with somebody of a different race. But I didn't think of it that way because we were kids and we were just having fun. And so the next time we were like, can I stay all night again? And my mom was like, yeah, go ahead, I guess. So that was my first experience as a result of the DSEG Act and being bussed to stay all night with someone of a different race.
In the year after the desegregation order, residents were asked to visit with students and teachers to monitor the success or failure of desegregation. A report from August 1977 talks about discipline, health, and safety of the classroom. The monitor wrote of a Pleasant Hill classroom, the children seem to get along fine. They're very unconcerned of their play and in the classrooms as to their friends being black or white. While the makeup of the classrooms morphed to reflect the city's demographics, critics say the achievement gap changed little. Tomorrow, we look at the failed effort to reevaluate the desegregation order. I'm Jenna Dooley.
A news report last week said that some lawyers are now starting to charge $1,000 per hour or more. Travis McNade says that's not quite as bad as some people think. He has this week's legal issues in the news.
Politicians are having a rough spell. Never an overly popular class of people. The U.S. Congress, in particular, has spent years in the public's likability cellar, getting worse press even than vampires. And state legislators aren't a whole lot more popular. The Illinois General Assembly, in a lame duck session, raised income taxes so high, so fast, they managed to irritate everyone from sandwich makers to sandwich millionaires. And, as if Illinois wasn't already lousy with them, politicians are now immigrating here from neighboring states. In Urbana, you can't throw a brick without hitting an Indiana legislator, which, polls suggest, is as good a reason as any to throw a brick. In the ill-will stakes, only Mideast dictators have recently outpaced the political class in unpopularity. So, naturally, right on cue, American lawyers are stepping up to say, "Did you forget about us?" A Wall Street Journal report last week has drawn a lot of attention in the midst of the continuing recession. It noted that some attorneys have broken through an important monetary ceiling, the charging $1,000 per hour ceiling. For the past couple of years, the article notes, most of the nation's elite law firms have been hesitant to ask more than $990 per hour for fear of how it might look. So the recent small steps past the 1K barrier were at first tentative and fraught with danger. Not exactly like Chuck Yeager pushing the X1 past the speed of sound, but attorneys will enjoy the comparison. As more law firms have followed suit, the high mark has grown by leaps and bounds, and the embarrassment has not limited their riches. The article reports that some lawyers now go for as much as $1,250 per hour. But while this may seem like just one more reason to hate lawyers, the truth is, of course, more complicated. Quite simply, these lawyers' hours are not like everyone else's. The expensive allotments of time the Journal was talking about are billable hours, and billable hours are like hours concentrate. At most law firms, attorneys keep close track of the time they spend, usually in 6-minute increments, noting who they worked for and what they did. Only when they can add up 10 of these 6-minute segments of solid work can they bill an hour to the client. So, developing a case strategy, drafting a discovery motion, taking a deposition, talking to opposing counsel, billable. But filling a coffee cup, watering the plant, using the restroom, or imagining what a great novel your life would make if only your client was the mob and you lived in Memphis, not billable. Also generally not billable, developing new clients, devoting time to learning something you should already know, or spending 3 hours researching what should take 30 minutes. For young attorneys, this can be a difficult concept. Just showing up to work and sitting at a desk means nothing. Water cooler talk, waiting for the computer to start, and reading internet news can't be billed. That matters, because attorneys at these large firms are expected to bill up to 2,000 hours per year. That breaks down, roughly, to about 40 billable hours per week. Again, that doesn't sound bad until you understand that no attorney spends an 8-hour day billing. For many attorneys, particularly young ones, it takes 11 or 12 hours at the office to make 8 billable. Even experienced attorneys sometimes spend a quarter of their time at the office